This is Jim Sklavunis of the Vanity Set, and you're listening to 90.7 FM, WGXC, Accra.
Find out where the music takes you on the next Deep Threes, when Paris-based jazz trio The Recyclers get a hold of a synthesizer. Plus tracks from Otmar Liebert, Mary Halverson, and Chris Carter. Deep Threes, music beyond boundaries for a digital world.
Tune in to Deep Threes after the noon news on Monday at WGXC 90.7 FM.
I'm Tom Rowe at WGXC, and reminding you that our WGXC 10-year anniversary pledge drive is from October 17th to October 31st this year. And we could sure use your help at wgxc.org/donate to make a difference in your community. We're looking for about 50 more new sustaining supporters to make sure community radio can come your way every hour on the hour, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. 90.7 FM is filled with the voices of your friends and neighbors talking about and having community conversations about local issues and providing all sorts of entertainment, music, and more. If that's something you support, consider a donation today at wgxc.org/donate. Or make a donation during the WGXC 10-year pledge drive from October 17th through 31st. For the radio, 90.7 FM, WGXC, your community radio station.
Give me liberty or give me death.
WGXC, the station that gives you liberty.
Take your Wellingtons off, children. And Mammy will tell you a pleasant story.
Good evening, this is Foraging Ahead. I'm Kevin Factor. Tonight on Foraging Ahead, I sit down with Franz Nicolay. Franz is a musician and a writer living in the Hudson Valley. A member of the Hold Steady and other projects, his first book, The Humorless Ladies of Border Control, touring the punk underground from Belgrade to Ulan Bator, was named a season's best travel book by the New York Times. Someone Should Pay for Your Pain is his first novel. Tonight, Franz talks about Someone Should Pay for Your Pain, and also the craft of songwriting, and what for him makes a good lyric. It's a fantastic book. If you've ever been part of a scene, if you've ever been a musician or a poet, or even just a fan in your 20s, if you've ever been in your 20s and searched for something, a direction, and found it or didn't find it and then got a job and a career, this is a book that is littered with gems. It is unsparing. It is kind. It is thoughtful, brutal, funny. The characters are just, you know them. The book is published by Gibson House Press, and you can get a copy of the book if it sounds interesting to you, which it should, from either GibsonPress.com or visit FranzNicolay.com if you'd like to buy this book or hear what he has to say with his music or his other book, The Humorless Ladies of Border Control. First up, we talk lyrics. What makes a good lyric, what he likes, and a little bit how he evolved himself as a musician and a lyricist. Franz Nicolay.
You know, I think sometimes people don't, the best lyrics are not the ones that people think of as incredible lyrics. Like, I think Iggy Pop is an extraordinary lyricist, you know, without being ostentatious about it. You know, Streetwalking Cheetah with a Heart Full of Napalm, that's incredible, you know. But also, you know, Joey Ramone, you know, beat on the brat with a baseball bat in the context of that song is the perfect lyric. So I think that's the root of these questions about, you know, when Dylan got the Nobel Prize in Literature, right? Like, that's a thing that happens, so lyrics have are canonized in that way. The question is this extra zhuzh they get from the music they're attached to. And to what extent they're extractable from that. You know, I think the lyrics to Search and Destroy actually are extractable from their musical content. And there are lyrics, you know, someone like Bill Callahan, probably, David Berman, obviously, who was a poet, in addition to being a lyricist. I don't know, I'm sort of rambling.
No. I mean, you kind of touched on a lot of the questions that like the follow-up questions that I would have. Is that, like, can you, often songwriters work from the tune or the melody first, and then the lyrics. But sometimes some people work the opposite way, or especially if there's a collaboration. You have here's, hey, I got these lyrics and I got this tune.
Yeah, the old-fashioned Tin Pan Alley model.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I have actually changed over the course of my songwriting time. When I was younger, I used to write the melody first and then sort of hang vowel sounds on it and then hang the lyrics on those vowel sounds. And now I'll definitely write the lyrics first. And I think that, you know, that affects the way, the kind of melodies you write, right? If the lyrics are driving the ship, you get these irregular harmonic structures and probably slightly less capacious melodies.
And at this stage, that's more interesting to you?
At this stage, that's more interesting to me because I got more interested in what words could do, which is also why I started writing books, because then you're not, because you got a little more room on the page than you do in a rhyme scheme and a metrical structure of lyrics. But that doesn't mean I don't try to squeeze a lot of stuff into the lyrics. I think the other thing about the way lyrics work as a literary form is that they happen on a time axis. Like if you're reading poetry on a page, you can to some extent take in the shape of the thing in one glance, even before you read the individual lines. But in a musical context, you do have to wait for the words to be presented to you. You know, in the same way that if you're at a reading, you have to. And so that has an effect on the way I think you think about structuring the form of the lyrics.
Well, I mean, Leonard Cohen, obviously poet first, musician second, singer
last. Although a very effective vocalist in his way, you know. I heard an interview recently where someone was talking about recounting. They were talking about the Traveling Wilburys, and somebody had been interviewing Roy Orbison and asked him, "What's it like to work with all these other singers?" And he said, "Oh, I'm a singer. They're stylists."
Interesting.
Which I think he's not wrong, you know. And Leonard Cohen is a very effective stylist.
Often what you get from the lyrics or the words is completely different than the feeling and the mood that you get from the music. And that's, like, I'm not a huge fan of the Smiths, but one of the things I enjoyed about the Smiths was just the absolute, like, morose nature of Morrissey's lyrics. And this, the jaunty tunes,
yes,
that they were attached to, that tension.
Yes.
Totally made, you know, like their music.
Yeah, always, you know, works. I mean, that's, not, you know, Hegelian dialectic, right? The thesis and the antithesis. Marr and Morrissey.
Uh-huh. So who are some other lyricists, or what are some other that you would...
That I really admire?
That you really admire.
I mean, John Darnielle and Mountain Goats is incredible. I mean, I was, you know, I don't know, off the top of my head.
Interesting you mentioned Springsteen, like early Springsteen.
Well, I you know, I've gone back and forth on Springsteen, you know. I think there was 1 year where I started listening to him and I listened to everything, you know. But I quickly tired of it because it's so, the Born to Run stuff is so self-serious and melodramatic that it wore itself out for me. And so now if I go to Springsteen, I'm going to go to that earlier stuff because at least it's a little more fun. You know, it's pretentious, it's over, you know, it's over the top, it's like spilling out at the edges, but it's like but it's like a young guy having fun, and that appeals to me more than like you know, Bruce the American icon carved out of stone and photographed in black and white,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
expressing, you know, the consciousness of the working class or whatever it is he thinks he's doing.
I love that he took Pete Seeger songs on the road.
Oh, that record's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, tubas and accordions. That's
yeah.
cool.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I like Bruce. I'm not giving him a hard time, but there is this sort of like, you know.
No, you know. I think you pretty much summed it up. Yeah. But it's, he's got, man, his heart's in the right place.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not mad at him. I think he takes himself a little seriously, and that's a bummer that when anybody does that.
Sure.
You know, Patti Smith does the same thing. Doesn't mean she's less of an artist if she's constantly conscious of herself as a genius with a capital G.
Huh? Have you read Just Kids?
I started it. I don't actually like her prose that much. Again, for the same reason. Like, it's a little self-serious.
Yeah, yeah.
Prince, he's my guy.
Yeah, I know he's your guy.
I love Prince.
But as a lyricist?
He has his moments. It's not the first thing I go to for Prince.
Uh-huh.
You know, but especially when he lets himself get weird.
Mm-hmm.
There's like, if I was your girlfriend, is the kind, you know, only Prince is going to write that song.
Mm-hmm.
You know, When You Were Mine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of these are incredible lyrics. That's not the first thing I think of with Prince usually.
Mm.
But he has his moments.
Mm. Jason Isbell.
Isbell's fantastic. Yeah. One of the best.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's in a very specific lineage, and he's very good in that lineage.
What lineage do you know?
You know, American folk country storytelling and song,
mm-hmm.
you know, with all that sort of craft and, you know, shaving the story down to the bare bones.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, also, he's an incredible singer and guitar player, so.
Yeah.
He's got the whole package.
No, I love one of the things I love about sort of the old songs or that people, in, like the songs in that lineage, it's just the scope of them. Like, there's the whole arc of a life in, like, 3 minutes.
I mean, that's what... First of all, it's professionalized songwriting, right? In the way... professionalized songwriting has remained a feature of Nashville in a way that it was in the Tin Pan Alley days, and the way that that went away in rock and roll after Dylan, right? The valorization of the singer-songwriter, of the person writing their own lyrics in rock became, you know, overtook this idea that the Lieber-Stoller model,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the country world, you still had these people who, you know, they may have had their own records, but, you know, professional songwriters, your Tom T. Halls,
mm-hmm.
R.I.P. And so there's this attention to a songwriting craft that remains there. And I think what you're saying, you know, like when I turn on a modern country station as a grown person, I understand the appeal of it because it is talking about aspects of grown-up people's lives in a way that, you know, the pop radio doesn't always.
Hmm. What do you mean grown-up people's lives?
People over 30. You know, even indie rock has a tendency for people to act like they're perpetually 25.
Right.
You know, in subject matter and also just like the way they carry themselves publicly. You don't get a lot of family life, for example.
You don't get a lot of family life. Yeah, okay.
And you get family life in country music.
That's true. You don't get a lot of family life in rock and roll, I suppose. Or
no, because
it's not the audience.
It's not the audience. It's not the people who are making it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even the people who are making it in their 30s and 40s tend to be like...
romanticizing it.
Well, no, like literally like single men living in urban Bohemia. So it's like, it's just not a topic for them.
Mm-hmm. I know for me, I'm terrible. Like my musical consumption is like pretty much ended in like 2001. Like in terms of like new, I mean, I listen to new music, but I'm not actively seeking it like I was earlier.
That's natural.
Is it? All right.
They've done studies on this.
Have they?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, so like my son is just like listening, he listens to stuff that I was listening to at his age that was like new and exciting to me. And he's like, and for him, it's a nostalgia trip.
Yeah.
You know, or like, oh, this is like, you know, all this old stuff.
Yeah.
This is contemporary. No,
yeah.
It's not. It's
yeah.
not. You know, and you just carry your music through you with your life at that point. You know, and I finally realized recently how my dad could not know who the Beatles were.
Yeah.
You know, or
absolutely.
Like, or my grandmother, like, having all these, like, these catchy little tunes from the 20s.
Yes.
You know, just, like, in her, because that's, you know, that's when you're formed.
Yeah, and whatever was popular or whatever you were listening to between the ages of, like, 16 and 25, that's your core musical.
Right.
Taste.
Do you ever look back on your own earlier work? Can you do that?
And sometimes.
How do you react to that, or what do you do you recognize the person who wrote that?
I remember them.
Yeah.
You know, often I'm embarrassed of them, but and sometimes I'm pleasantly surprised.
Okay, that's cool.
Sometimes I'll be like, you know, sometimes I'll even scavenge it if there's something, if it was one piece of good thing in a song that. You know, no. Otherwise, no one will ever hear. I'll be like, oh, I'll use that for a thing that people will hear.
Nicolay follows singer-songwriter Rudy Pulver, his conflicted relationship with a successful former protege and a young niece who wants to travel with him and whose surprise appearance forces a reckoning with himself and his past. In the doldrums of a career as a cult figure, singer-songwriter Rudy has been overshadowed by Ryan Orland, to the point where Rudy is now identified as an imitator of the younger man. Ryan is generous and supportive of Rudy, but Rudy finds it hard to be grateful. Forced to confront the limitations of his own talent and ambition, his resentment triggers a confrontation that ends in their estrangement. When Rudy's niece, a teenage runaway who admires the freedom of his lifestyle, turns up asking to join him on the road, he has to come to terms with the nature of his obligation to family and accountability for his past. Someone Should Pay for Your Pain is an exploration of the nature of creativity and popular success, artistic and ethical influence, the pathos of middle-aged artist, changing standards of sexual morality, and guilt and penance in a post-religious society. What made you want to write this book?
I think it was, it just seemed like the next challenge.
Mm-hmm.
I'd started writing about a decade before and, you know, worked my way up from just keeping very detailed diaries when I was traveling to writing these, you know, longer and longer magazine pieces. And then I had my first book, The Humorless Ladies of Border Control, which is a sort of a literary travelogue that did, you know, didn't set the world on fire, but did well enough that that I could justify writing another book. And it seemed like that the next step from there would be to try to write long form fiction. Mm. I had been asked to contribute to an anthology of short stories, and I wrote a version of what's now the first chapter of this novel for that anthology. And it sort of suggested to me that I could expand on that character. And, you know, there was a lot implied about his backstory that would be, it seemed like it wouldn't be too hard to write the first 100 pages. And then hopefully by the time I was done with that, I'd have figured out what the rest of the book was going to be.
And is that how you approached it?
That's exactly how it worked.
And where did you hit the wall, or did you hit the wall?
Well, I knew, you know, without spoiling too much about the book, I knew I was going to write the story of the expats, his old band, and the whole story with Ryan, the younger guy who admires him and then surpasses him, mm-hmm. you know, classic Star is Born show business story. And I kind of knew how their falling out was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And then beyond that, I wasn't quite sure. In the meantime, I had written a piece for Slate about musicians who tour with their children, who bring their children on tour. And particularly one of the musicians I highlighted was this guy, Ed Hamill, who goes by the name professionally Hamill on Trial, who's been, after the breakup of his marriage, as a way of connecting with his son, started bringing him on the road on his summer tours, starting when he was 7, and they still do it now. His son is in college, so they've been doing it for over a decade. And I just love that idea of this older singer-songwriter and the younger relative driving around the country. Obviously, Ed has nothing to do with Rudy. It's just that idea. And in the first half of the book, I had, you know, there's a mention of the sister and the young niece, and I thought, oh, well, there's an opportunity, you know. And it's a good way to give Rudy some a level of perspective that he hasn't had for a very long time at that point in his career by being confronted with a much younger person who actually is maybe the one person in the world who sort of admires the life that he's living and forces him to decide whether he really wants to defend it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, Rudy, I love all the characters in the book are really, really just multidimensional, complex. There are no simple characters. You got Rudy, you got Ryan, you got Cass and Jules and Seb, and even some of the secondary characters like Poshlo and you get them. You're like, oh, I kind of know this guy, or I know this woman.
That's the hope. Well, that's the idea.
Well, I mean,
I'm glad it sort of worked.
Well, for me, it did. Yeah. You know, like the pathos of the middle-aged artist. Mm. That's a great line. But like at some point in an artist or a musician's career, you go from sort of that just fabulous energy of adolescence and your early 20s where you're just on fire, you're just wired, and there's that moment where you sort of cross over.
Yes.
You know, and some people make that transition and some people don't, and some people don't and don't know they haven't.
That's right. Yeah. That last is what Rudy is, right? Yeah. Even if you achieve a sort of escape velocity from that early rocket fuel, even for the most successful artists, I think there can be a long fallow period in terms of the attention that you can get when you're in your, you know, late 40s, 50s, and you're sort of carrying on in the hopes of a rediscovery, quote unquote. Which doesn't happen for everybody. Mm. I think of it, and then of course, if you never did achieve escape velocity, you don't always notice until it's too late. I and you know, Aaron Kamafus, who's a great writer about punk rock and underground scenes, has this great phrase in his new book, where he's looking back on the counterculture of his time, which is, you know, the 90s, particularly on the West Coast. And he talks about the people who are still at it and the people who dropped out. You know, he's in his early 50s now, I think. And he said, it's like you're running a race with all your friends, you know, and you're dressed up, you're having fun, you're all working, heading towards a destination together. And then all of a sudden you look around and you're the only one still running. And everyone else has sort of peeled off at various points and you didn't even really notice. Mm. And I think that's sort of what happened to Rudy.
Oh, yeah. But then you just have this momentum and then you just keep doing it.
Well, what else are you going to do? Yeah. You know, at that point, let's say, you know, there's a point at which most people who don't have a sustainable success in the music business are usually out by their early 30s at the latest. Mm. And then if you're the guy who holds on, it usually is guys, I've noticed, who hold on a little longer than they should.
I mean, it's the same thing marriages.
But at that point, then you're all your friends and your cohort have established their careers and they have young children and they have, you know, they're running stuff and you have a 10 or 15 year hole in your resume and you're starting from scratch. Mm. And that, I think, can be a painful thing to confront and to figure out, you know, what your identity is going to be at that point. Yeah, I sort of wrote it as a cautionary tale for myself, you know, as a guy who's about a decade older than me when I wrote it.
But for Rudy, he comes off as just kind of such a...
He's a sourpuss.
Sourpuss, yes. Yeah.
He's
That's
a grouch.
That's a radio-friendly word for the one that came to my mind. Sourpuss. And I can see, like, carrying on, you know, like, just sort of that, you know, marginal existence.
Just out of pure cussedness.
But I could, just out of spite.
Yes.
You know, which is, you know, a powerful motivator. But there's no joy.
Right.
You know, like, I'm sure you've seen as well, like, I mean, the joy that you get from playing music and, you know, it comes, you know, I think initially from just playing music and then maybe later from an audience or sort of a positive feedback loop. But then ultimately at the end, you know, if you're at Rudy's stage or if you've never even made it that far and you like to play music, just the act of playing and creating music is in and of itself an ends.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that goes on with Rudy is that he doesn't realize that the thing that drew him to this world in the first place was this sense of community and having this gang of the band and the group of friends, and that was the draw rather than the thing of playing music itself. So, but by the time where he spent a decade driving around the country by himself.
Right.
That's the part that's missing, and the writing of the songs and the playing of the songs in and of itself isn't enough to sustain him.
Yeah.
And so he has to retreat from the chosen family to the biological family.
Retreat. Oh, I don't know if it's a retreat.
It's a something. It's a move.
It's a tactical redirection, or it's forced upon it more than anything.
Yeah.
But that's interesting. I mean, you don't have to be a musician. Or an artist, or anything like that, to really connect with your scenes of early 20s life.
Yeah,
you know, it is. It's the excitement of a community, of a direction, or even a half baked ideology, which Seb provides, and a direction that everybody's going in. And it's, and then in order to maintain or continue in that community, you realize you have to contribute something. And if it's music, it's music. If it's poetry, God forbid, it's poetry, you know.
And sometimes you can be a part of that community just by being a super fan, too, like being the one who goes to all the events.
Right,
that's
right,
a huge...
Right.
The communities don't exist without those people as well.
That's, you know, that's... Yeah, that's great. That's a really good point.
But all of it requires this energy, right? Yeah. And because at that point you're not doing it... Like, nobody's making money for the most part.
Yeah.
And you forget that at a certain point you have to start making a little money if you want to keep doing it.
Well, I don't need...
And there's always this idea that, like, everyone around me is energetic and talented and we're all going to do it.
Yeah.
You know, we're all going to make it and this is going to be great. And the fact is most people, you know, almost no one is going to do that.
Right. That's... I think it's funny you use the word forget that you have to make money. When you're in your 20s...
You don't know.
I don't think you don't even know.
Yeah.
You know? You know, you get your crappy job, and you're like, oh, like, if six of us live in this apartment, like, with my crappy job, we could totally live forever on ramen or soup.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I love the soups, yeah.
The soup, the big pot of soup and the bread, to feed the whole house, absolutely. And then eventually you start being like, well, I can't... How much longer am I going to sleep on floors? I'm not going to sleep on floors anymore. And then it's like, I'm not going to sleep on a couch anymore. I need my own room. And then eventually you find, you know, you just start eliminating these ways of living cheaply on the road.
I hope that our few remaining friends give up on trying to save us. I hope we come up with a fail-safe plot to piss off the dumb few that forgave us. I hope the fences we mended fall down beneath their own weight. And I hope we hang on past the last exit. I hope it's already too late. And I hope the junkyard a few blocks from here someday burns down. And I hope the rising black smoke carries me far away, and I never come back town again. In my life, I hope I lie and tell everyone you were a good wife, and I hope you die. I hope we both die. If I cut myself shaving tomorrow, I hope it bleeds all day long. Our friends say it's darkest before the sun rises. We're pretty sure they're all wrong. I hope it stays dark forever. I hope the worst isn't over. And I hope you blink before I do. And I hope I never get sober. And I hope when you think of me years down the line, you can't find one good thing to say. And I'd hope that if I found the strength to walk out, you'd stay the hell out of my way. I am drowning. There is no sign of land. You are coming down with me. Hand in unlovable hand, and I hope you die. I hope we both die.
You shift time beautifully and genres.
I mean, one of the fun exercises, I don't know if this is what you mean by saying genre, giving myself little writing prompts that weren't just the narrative, like write a fake, you know, Pitchfork review in like with the worst cliches of rock writer jargon. Writing parts of songs for all the different characters, right? Because they express themselves in the kind of lyrics they write. So what's the kind of song that Rudy would write? What's the kind of song that Ryan would write? What's the kind of song that, you know, that Al Pashlo would write? What's the kind of song that would have been part of Rudy's juvenilia, right? Like what does a pretentious 17-year-old write?
Right.
You know. So yeah. those were fun exercises.
I love that you include lyrics in some of the parts of the book.
Not everybody likes that. I had shown it, the manuscript to some people, and, you know, I think I don't know why people had this objection to including lyrics, because they can't imagine what the music to it sounds like. Mm. But I feel like you can't write a book about singer-songwriters without including some of that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It would be kind of cheap.
You know, I often find, as someone who does write lyrics, that the books, the novels that I read by authors who are not themselves lyric writers, who write fake lyrics, don't scan for me.
Okay.
So I understand what they're saying. I tend to ascribe that to this idea that they don't actually know what makes a good lyric if you don't write 100 of them. But maybe I'm wrong about that. And you just, everybody has a tune in their head that they can't hear, that no one else can hear for that stuff.
Yeah, that's... And the transition from writing lyrics... I mean, you already made the transition from writing lyrics to writing articles and things like that.
Yeah.
And your nonfiction book. But because, I mean, there are passages in the book which are lyrical.
Mm.
In the traditional sense of the word.
I mean, I have these text files that have all the bits and pieces, you know, things I think of, descriptions of, you know, places as I'm driving by them, you know, little things I want to quote from something I read.
Uh-huh.
That all goes into the slush pile, and some of it turns into lyrics and some of it goes into the books. So
yeah.
You're right in the sense that, you know, in another world, some of that stuff could have been lyrics. Maybe it will be.
I mean, it all comes from the same source. Right?
Yeah,
from noticing.
I'm not against reusing the material.
No.
Beat on the brat with a baseball bat. Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh ho. Beat on the brat, beat on the brat, beat on the brat with a baseball bat. Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh ho. Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh ho.
I love the opening. Would you mind, giving a...
Sure.
Giving us a reading of that opening.
Part 1. Chapter 1. The kid wanted so much not to be the bad guy. Hey, Rudy, can I talk to you about the money? Here it comes, Rudy thought. I'm going to get the dictionary definition of guarantee tattooed on my damn arm. Listen, I know I said 500 in the email, but I just thought, you know, we got some good write-ups and it's winter up here, not much going on. The kid also wanted so much not to lose money. That's what these guys first learn when they decide they want to be promoters. You can be liked or you can make money. Thought it was a good turnout, right? I got 375. Can we do that? 500, said Rudy. Matter of fact, as I recall, the offer for the original date was 8. It's a 7-hour drive to get here. I took off work. Guess I could go to an ATM. He paused, waiting for Rudy to say, oh, you don't have to do that. Rudy waited back. I guess the mercy might yet come. I was really excited to have you come. It's a big deal for me, for my promotion company. I want you to be happy and let people know you had a good show here. I appreciate that. He sagged, punctured. I'll be right back. I'll get some money out of my own account. That is often how it's done, Rudy agreed.
Oh, man. That scene reminded me of a couple of scenes, actually, in The Humorless Ladies of Border Control.
Yeah.
Where you were, like, trying to get paid.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of these things. A lot of the, especially on punk and DIY circuits, the people who are putting on the shows are young and idealistic people. And they think everybody's going to be cool when it comes down to it. And you know, I find often if you're the person on tour, you're a little older and you need to pay for your gas and maybe you have a day off and you need to pay for a hotel room and you're not always in the mood to make a deal.
That presents Rudy's dilemma, like right off the bat. Like he knows exactly, he's been doing this so long. He knows
he's been through this scene before.
And he knows the kid doesn't want to be the bad guy. He knows, and he just knows how to wait through, you know, and just not give the answers that the kid is expecting, because the kid is, hasn't been through this before.
Right. He doesn't know that sometimes you lose money.
That sometimes you lose money. And but do you think that sort of, you know, idealism, as you say, is also kind of a function of sort of the middle or upper middle class background of a lot of the people who go into this?
I mean, I do think that a lot of people who end up in sort of counterculture and bohemian worlds are tend to have a certain kind of, not always that they come from money, but there's always a cushion. Mm. You know, there's always someone's house that you can go back to if it all goes pear-shaped. And you haven't always had to think about how to finance things. You know, you don't, even if you grow up middle class, you don't always have to think about who's paying for the groceries and how the groceries get paid for.
They blew up a chicken man in Philly last night. Now they blew up his house too. Down on the boardwalk, they're getting ready for a fight. Gonna see what them racket boys can do. Now there's trouble busting in from out of state, and the DA can't get no relief. Gonna be a rumble out on the promenade, and the gambling commission's hanging on by the skin of its teeth. Well, now everything dies, baby, that's a fact. Maybe everything that dies someday comes back. Put your makeup on, fix your hair pretty, and meet me tonight in Atlantic City. Well, I got a job and tried to put my money away, but I got debts that no honest man can pay. So I drew what I had from the Central Trust, and I bought us two tickets on that city bus. Baby, everything dies. Maybe that's a bet. But maybe everything that dies someday comes back.
So, an exploration of the nature of creativity.
Mm. I don't know. I didn't write the back cover blurb. You can talk to the publishers.
Talk to the publishers. It's a great blurb. It's a great blurb. Versus popular success.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I think there's a lot in terms of, like, who becomes successful and why.
Mm.
You know, and it doesn't always correlate to who is the most, has the most energy, or who's, like, has the most natural talent.
Mm.
There's some, you know, there's a kind of person that makes it easy for people to connect with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think Rudy and Ryan are set up in opposition in that way, you know? And there's, I think I say in the book at some point, just like, the world likes Ryans. Like, even if, let's say, I don't think we know that one of them is necessarily a better songwriter than the other. Mm-hmm. Like, that's impossible to say, objectively. But Ryan is the kind of guy that people like and that people connect with. And a part of it is because he has this desperation to connect with other people. And there is a class difference between him and Rudy. And maybe that's part of it.
Like, I think Ryan
comes from a working class, single parent household. And he needs to make something happen for himself in a way that you know, Rudy hasn't been forced to do up until the point where he's, you know, fending for himself. Mm-hmm. out of the back of his van.
Mm-hmm. And then he doesn't deal with it all that well.
Yeah, because he doesn't have that. He doesn't know that you have to meet people halfway. Ryan's more than willing to, like, reach out and hug everybody.
Yeah, 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 yeah. That's, yeah.
And people can sense that. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're sort of keeping them at arm's length, or if you want them to come in and mm-hmm. and join you in the feeling. I mean, the people that I've met when they were just starting out who went on to be famous,
uh-huh.
you can like smell it on them.
Really?
That's been my experience. Oh. I've been wrong a few times. You know, there's been a couple people where I've been like, oh, these folks are going to be famous, and it doesn't happen. But definitely the ones where it did, you could tell that they were just like, they were working the room. They had this intensity. They wanted to say yes to stuff. They were willing to bully people, you know, into getting in the van with them. You know, they were just like relentless and a little bit ruthless.
I mean, you've had you know, success in the music. And...
Yeah, I think I had that quality about myself too when I was in my 20s. Absolutely, of just like starting projects and wrangling people into them, mm-hmm. and like, you know, schlepping stuff all over the city and putting up flyers and, you know, talking myself into, you know, guesting on people's sets and stuff like that, just like making myself visible.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Where does that come from?
Where did I don't know, ego, I suppose. Probably.
Yeah.
But just wanting to make it happen.
I mean, a lot of people want to make it happen, but just don't know how to do that.
Well, nobody knows how to do it. When they start, unless their folks are in the business, which happens sometimes, but you have to be willing to embarrass yourself a little bit. I think that's one of those things. Like, I think Rudy has too much of a sense of his own dignity sometimes.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, even now, like, as a, you know, I'm a middle-aged guy, mm-hmm. with a career as a musician, but I didn't know how to get into the book business, so I just sort of Googled around and emailed 100 agents, and three of them responded, and it just sort of went from there. You know, I'm still willing to not, you know, there's a publicist for the book, but I'm also like behind the scenes, sending copies out.
Yeah,
and
I mean, you're sitting down in my backyard for basically like the third interview for this one book.
Yeah.
There are no deaths.
I like the hustle, you know?
Yeah.
I like doing the hustle. Makes me feel like I'm doing something.
Well, you are. You're hustling, isn't?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm in the habit of it.
Really?
Yeah.
That's so funny you say that, because a lot of people hate the hustle.
Well, obviously, if you get to a point where someone else can do it for you, that's preferable. But I'm not at that point. I'll probably never be at that point.
Yeah.
And honestly, no one's ever going to be able to do it as well as you can, because they're not as intimately involved in your work.
Of course.
And they don't know all, like, you know, I got 20 years of people in the press that I've dealt with, or people, you know, who have been interested in one aspect of my work but don't know about the other half. And, you know, I can write that stuff all down in a document for the publicist, but they don't know those people.
Yeah,
it's better if it comes from me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it's, and yeah, you're cheerful and enthusiastic, and
you're catching me at a good time. It's not always like this.
Well, that's why I got the Danish in the coffee. Right?
There we go.
It's the apology Danish. That's what I call it. You're actually the first guy who's gotten apology Danish.
I'm gonna steal that.
You're welcome to it. You're welcome to it. I love the title. You're, you know, if nothing else, you should buy this book just for the title. Someone should pay for your pain. There's so many different ways you can go with like that title.
Yes.
Where did you get the name?
The original working title of the book was something different, which was much more boring, and everybody told me it was boring, but I was really attached to it, and eventually a friend of mine told me, you've mistaken your central metaphor for your title. And she was right. And so I went back through the book looking for a better title. And there's this... there's a billboard that he drives by, I think it's in Wyoming or something like that, for a personal injury lawyer, and says someone should pay for your pain.
Yeah.
And I thought, there it is, yep, that's the title. Because it you know, it combines that feeling of resentment that drives Rudy.
Mm-hmm.
It's really unfounded resentment, like no one has really ever done anything bad to him.
Yeah.
But that's what's driving him. That self-pity,
mm-hmm.
right? There's a fine line between self-pity and self-deprecation,
uh-huh.
and one of them is way more appealing than the other. I mean, I did this, I had an idea for who this character was, And I sort of, I was thinking about Misanthropy and classic. Yeah. the classical depictions of misanthropes. So like Timon of Athens and Molière and, you know, even Mark Antony and Plutarch. You know, after one of his defeats, he retreats to this little encampment on an island away from the world. And like, what in this sort of classic imagination turns someone into this kind of angry, self-pitying, resentful character? And it usually comes from this feeling of, it seems like it usually comes from this feeling of not being appreciated by the world. Like I've done all this, or I have all these talents, and nobody appreciates them, and therefore, screw y'all.
Right. Nobody loves me.
Nobody loves me. Therefore, I hate everyone. And meanwhile, everyone's like, "Who are you again?"
No, I'll show you.
Yeah. Exactly.
But
there you go. Yeah.
Oh, that's right. I cut you off before you finish that thought.
No, but that seemed to me like it applied. You know, that's relevant to Rudy.
Mm-hmm.
And this idea that you wanted that somebody needs to be punished, or somebody
but
needs to be.
He's not a wholly unsympathetic character. Like,
very few people are total monsters.
I found him extremely, extremely sympathetic.
Yeah, I mean, I think what I was hoping is that you can, you know, even if this guy's not very likable, and I think we understand that fictional protagonists shouldn't be called upon to be likable, you understand how he gets to the place he gets to,
mm-hmm.
and that he's that he can, you know, he can't find his way all the way back, but he can find his way to a different, slightly nicer place.
Mm. It's funny that I actually took the title a completely different way,
mm.
you know, and I, you know, which was that as an artist, right?
Oh yeah, the marketing of your own
trauma, your own trauma, and you know, and
that's there too.
Yeah, yeah. So that's how I initially interpreted it. That, yeah, you know, here's my pain, and I'm going to package it for you, and you're going to connect with my pain, and it'll make you feel better. But you know, I need to make a living.
Right, because it doesn't heal anything.
Well, I don't know. You don't feel like. I always feel better after. If I'm down and I listen to some Tom Waits.
Oh, no, I'm saying.
I always feel better.
I know, for the consumer of it, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, but for the artist, you know, I'm not sure.
No.
Maybe you have to make a lot of money off it.
What?
There are these fleeting moments.
But, I mean, but don't you personally, like, feel, you get a nice, warm, fuzzy feeling, or
absolutely
when somebody really connects you with your music.
Absolutely, it's fantastic. I'm being a little blithe.
No, that's fine. Or even find something in your music that you didn't even know was there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, mm-hmm. It goes out into the world and starts doing a different kind of work.
Yeah,
than you created it to do.
Is that a weird feeling the first time you get that? Or
no, it's a great feeling.
Yeah,
you want that.
Yeah,
you know. Yeah, that's the hope.
So I guess I won't take up much more of your time. And if there's anything else, Sam
Lipsyte
says,
the great Sam Lipsyte,
the great Sam Lipsyte.
Yes.
For those of you who don't know, he calls this wise, brutal, and funny.
He would know.
He must have read this book.
Yes, he did.
He must have read this book. The cover. Did you have any? There's the cover is a sort of a god's eye view of a highway along a frozen landscape,
mm-hmm.
which works sort of on so many levels metaphorically. You know, the main character himself is sort of frozen or stuck in some just. Bitter extended adolescence, and he's just traveling through this frozen landscape. But did you have much say or choice in this, or how did you come up with
it? I had some say.
Yeah.
There was a cover designer who created a number of options, and this was neither my first choice nor the the editor's first choice, but it's the one we compromised on. Oh. But I've come around on it,
I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I did, you know, in terms of the content, I one of the sort of foundation forms of the book is that it starts in, like, sweaty tropical Florida, and it ends in wintry Canada, mm-hmm. you know, and which is sort of the emotional progress of the character as well. So I'm glad that the designer picked up on that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that was good. No, it's, so are you going to be giving any readings? Are you going to be performing? Where can people see you? Where can people buy this book?
Well, they can buy it anywhere that you buy books. If you want it directly from me, you can get it at franznikolai.com. I'll sign it and send it to you.
Oh.
But it's, it's all in the usual places.
You don't have.
I will. We did a book launch in Brooklyn at the end of August when it came out. I mean, it's tricky right now with bookstores because I don't think everyone's doing in-person events. And the Zoom events, you know, I actually think the book event is one of the few performance genres that was somewhat improved by being on Zoom.
Really?
Yeah. Because book events are great for the performer. You know, it's at a reasonable time. You're done by 8 o'clock. You can go out for a nice dinner. You can, you know, for someone who's used to music touring where you're carrying a bunch of gear and you go on at 11 and you don't get to bed until 2 or 3 in the morning. The first time I did a book tour, I was like, this is fantastic. This is amazing.
Everybody uses.
But I understand that for the viewer, it's not a scintillating live event necessarily. And it's usually at an awkward time. You know, you don't have time to get dinner after work necessarily, blah, blah, blah. Whereas, you know, on Zoom, it was like you could gather the 10 people in every city who might be interested in the event and get a 100-person audience and they can just log on from their office. Like, I would do that. But for the bookstores, of course, you know, if you have 10 people coming to an event, they feel a sort of obligation to buy a book.
Mm-hmm.
And no one on a Zoom event, it's not moving any units. For the bookstore that's hosting them. So I think they've sort of soured on that. So I don't know. I'd love to do some events. We're trying to set them up. It's a little tricky right now. It's not a great time.
The road is dangerous. And pretty and white. Tires spinning on snow. Spinning heavy and slow, and I'm headed home. Time itself means nothing. Time spent with you a Donald Sutherland interview comes on the truck radio. He apologizes to all